This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. When she got off the plane in Africa last year, Ella Stryker had no idea she was about to come face to face with one of the worst medical crises in years, the Ebola outbreak.
And you watch entire families die. You see villages that are wiped out, and it's devastating. There's nothing in life that prepares you for that kind of experience.
It's an interview with one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year, Ebola fighter Ella Stryker. Plus, the state budget stalemate shows no signs of giving way. Meanwhile, state-run museums are closing. The IPR Politics Roundtable examines the fallout. And vocalist Michelle Lordy talks about her new CD, Drive. That's during an edition of Jazz Next. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Monday, October 5th, 2015. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Time Magazine named the many volunteers fighting last year's Ebola outbreak in Western Africa their Persons of the Year. One of the volunteers selected to literally be the face of this effort was Ella Stryker, a New Jersey native and public educator who began volunteering only last year with Doctors Without Borders. Her face was one of the five chosen to be on the magazine cover. Ella Stryker spoke recently at ISU on the topic, the health educator's role in the effort to control Ebola. And she joins us in the studio today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You were a part of the initial Ebola response in Guinea. You went on missions to Liberia, Sierra Leone. Your first mission in March of last year was to Guinea. What were you expecting and what was expected of you?
I actually left the United States not knowing that I was going to an Ebola outbreak. So the test results that the cases that they were finding in Guinea where Ebola came while I was on the airplane.
So what did you think you were going to do?
I knew it was a viral hemorrhagic fever outbreak. And at the time, we were thinking and hoping it was Lassa fever, which is a much less deadly fever, virus than Ebola.
But you knew in the back of your mind that it could be Ebola?
I hadn't really thought about the possibility that it was Ebola. Looking back on it now, I realize that was very naive. But no, in my head, it was really, I didn't think that I was going to an Ebola outbreak. It was a big surprise to get off the airplane and to realize where I was headed.
So what were you thinking when you landed in Africa amidst the Ebola outbreak? So what were you thinking when you finally landed in that situation and thought, well, now I have to get to work?
Well, first, I passed through our office in Geneva, and I received a briefing from people who are very experienced working in Ebola. So that was really helpful for me to sort of dispel some of the myths about Ebola and to give me some factual information. Then arriving in country, it was really obvious from the beginning that this was a very different type of outbreak than we had seen before. The spread of cases was much larger than past outbreaks, and it was only a few days after I'd arrived at the end of March that we had cases coming in Conakry and Liberia. So I think for us, it was obvious that this was going to be a big outbreak. I think for the rest of the world, it was at first, it was really seen as this small localized outbreak.
So were you thinking, my gosh, what have I gotten myself into here? How did you decide to approach the actual situation once you were confronted with it?
I think when you're in that situation, every day there's so much to do that you don't have that much time to think about it. So you're really reacting. And when you're in an emergency context, when you're getting new information every hour, you're just responding and you're doing what you need to do on the ground. And then later you look back and realize how big it was. And what a big news story it ended up being. But when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't feel like that. It's just the work you have to do.
So first you were in Guinea, and then you went to Liberia and Sierra Leone. How did those situations, how were they different? How were they similar?
They were really, really different. So in Guinea, the first mission I worked on was in Gekidu. It's forested Guinea. It's a very remote, very rural area. And the second mission in Kailahun in Sierra Leone also was actually just across the river. So the communities are very closely linked. They're the same ethnic group, the same families. But later, working in Monrovia was a completely different situation. It was an urban area. People have access to internet. We had to monitor social media. Our job in health education, health promotion, is to make sure people have factual information about Ebola virus and they know how to protect themselves. And it's very different to do that when you're in a rural community than when you're in a massive urban area.
In the Time magazine article, you were quoted as saying the fight against Ebola was akin to fighting a forest fire with spray bottles. What made it so seemingly futile?
We arrived in an outbreak not knowing how big the outbreak was. The cases in Guinea actually started at least in December of 2013. So we didn't know until the end of March. That meant the virus was spreading for months before anyone knew. And then historically, Doctors Without Borders was the only organization that responded to provide medical care to Ebola patients. For 5 months, we were completely alone in trying to respond to this outbreak. And that was the point at which I had written those words for actually an MSF blog that was then picked up, that we were fighting a forest fire with spray bottles, because no matter what we did, it was never enough. There were always new ambulances, new cases. We added new beds to our hospitals, but we were adding the beds slower than the patients were coming in.
Did you ever fear for your own life, your own safety, your own health?
I think Ebola is a virus that scares everyone. And we often say in the field that if you're not a little bit afraid, then you should probably go home. Because that level of fear is what keeps you safe. And you have to be hypervigilant. Working in Ebola has been compared to working in a war zone. You can't afford to make mistakes. And so, yes, there's always that element of fear, but it's balancing the fear in a way that keeps you safe rather than creates more harm.
Did you ever feel like, I can't handle this, I need to get out of here?
Part of what my organization does is they send international staff for very short periods of time. When we're in the field, we work really long hours and we usually don't take days off. But we go for 6 weeks, 8 weeks. The longest I was in the field was 10 weeks. And that keeps you from getting to the point where you can't keep going. But we're also really responsible for ourselves and for each other to say, hey, you know what? You're too tired. You need to take a break. And there's no one will think poorly of you or look down on you if you say, like, this is when I need to leave.
So would you recommend this kind of work for other people? Do you think that other people would benefit by doing this sort of thing? Or does it take a special kind of person? Obviously, we're talking about physicians in this case, but people doing this kind of work in general.
So the teams that I worked with were doctors and nurses, but also water and sanitation engineers, logisticians, accountants, human resource professionals. It's a big team of people, and we need all of these different backgrounds, as well as epidemiologists and public health specialists and anthropologists and psychologists. And all of those backgrounds and all of those profiles are really important. We can't remove one of those people and still have a strong team. But you also have to be able to do this kind of work. You can't bring your family with you. You have to be able to go on your own. And it's incredibly difficult work. Most of our patients die. And that's something that you have to keep getting up the next day and going to work, knowing that what you're doing is so small compared to what's needed. So I'm not sorry I did it, but it was really difficult. And there are things that I think I've learned and I've grown from the experience, but I paid a pretty big price for it.
How do you gather up the strength to fight a battle like that? Like you said, most of your patients die. How do you go to work the next day knowing that, you know, you may see a massive failure rate, but you got to keep on going?
For me, it was my colleagues that kept me going. I had staff who worked with me who were Guinean staff who I started working with at the very beginning of the outbreak. In a way, we grew up together. We had to learn this new virus together. We had to learn how to engage and work in communities that were terrified of us, that were more afraid of us than they were of the virus. And they showed up for work every day, and they had the energy to keep going. And their families stigmatized them. Their families were afraid that they were going to spread the virus. And they showed up for work every day anyway, and they kept working. And these people are still working in Guinea because the outbreak's not over. It's been a year and a half, and they have kept going. And that, for me, is the source of inspiration.
Did you create relationships with people, maybe even some of the people you were treating, and become maybe even close to these folks and then watch them suffer and maybe even pass away? How do you deal with something like that?
I think that's an aspect of the work that I was completely unprepared for. my job as a health promoter was to really be able to engage with communities and provide the link between the medical care that we were providing and how the community received us and understood what we were doing. And in order to do that, I needed communities to trust me. And I needed them to trust that our organization was there to help, because that wasn't obvious to them. But when you work that closely with a community, when you're there every day, when you're talking to them, you get to know them really well and they get to know you. And then a lot of those people that you build that level of trust with, they're the ones who are getting sick and dying. And you watch entire families die. You see villages that are wiped out. And it's devastating. There's no, there's nothing in life that prepares you for that kind of experience. And I think what you do to protect yourself is you take a break from it. And that's where being an international staff has this privilege, because I can go home. And I can go home to my family and my friends. For our national staff, for my colleagues who are there all the time, they don't have that ability to detach. They're there for the long haul. And honestly, I don't know how they do it.
Your talk at ISU centered on the health educator's role in the effort to control Ebola. What is the role of health educators, and how can they best contribute?
For me, health educators are really the core of how to respond to an outbreak like Ebola. When you have an epidemic of this proportion, you cannot possibly get ahead of the virus unless everyone is on board. And so you need communities to really understand. They have to understand what the virus is, they have to understand how to protect themselves, and they have to understand which behaviors will promote good health and which behaviors will make them get sick and die. And so it's a population level perspective that you bring to the work, but that at the same time you're engaging with individual people, because one person in a community who has a lot of power and influence can change the entire landscape of your work. So there's this ultimate tension between the individual relationships and keeping that perspective that the entire population has to be reached. When people think about Ebola in Africa, it's so removed and it's so different, but a lot of the work that we do at the community level is the same work that needs to be done in the U.S. So if you think about what's the role of a health educator, of a health promoter, it's really about building trust, and it's about being that link between a medical service that maybe seems very remote and very distant from the community they're trying to serve, and linking people so that they feel that they can take control over their health and well-being, and that they can make decisions that are the right decisions for them.
How has being the face of Time Magazine's Person of the Year changed Ella Stryker?
For me, it was completely unexpected, actually. They told me that they were doing a profile of different people for an oral history project on their website. So everyone just be aware, if Time Magazine comes to you with a story like this, be suspicious. And it was only when the magazine came out that I learned that I was one of the people on the cover. They did an issue with 5 covers and profiling different people who had been part of the response. So for me, it's a lot of pressure, actually, to be one of 5 people representing tens of thousands of people who stood up and responded to a massive catastrophe. And especially being someone who came from outside, but realizing that most of the people who responded were responding in their own communities. They were looking after their own families. And I was really privileged to be able to join them and to work alongside them.
So what's next for you? Mm-hmm. You consider yourself based in New York, but you still work in Africa. What's next for you?
I'm not sure what's next. The Ebola outbreak is not over. It's the situation's a lot better than it was even just a couple months ago, but it's not over. And at the same time, there are a lot of other humanitarian catastrophes right now. There's a measles outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo that's killed hundreds of children, completely unnecessarily, because we have a measles vaccine that could have saved all of those children's lives. So there's lots of humanitarian emergencies in the world, and I'll probably be working on one of them.
Well, we look forward to hearing and reading more about it maybe in the future. Ella Stryker, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ella Stryker and other volunteers combating the Ebola virus were named Time Magazine's Persons of the Year. It was Stryker's photo, among others, on the cover of last December's issue. She spoke recently at Illinois State University. Ella Stryker says the entire outbreak could have been avoided, calling the crisis a shared failure. Her appearance in Normal was sponsored by ISU's Department of Health Sciences and the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation Nolte Fund.
Support for GLT comes from Bob Dennison Ford Toyota, embracing a more sustainable future with hybrid vehicles for almost any utility, including the Prius, Camry, Highlander, and Avalon from Toyota, and the Escape, Fusion, and C-Max from Ford. Bob Dennison is proud to support Illinois State University and GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Ahead, music critic Carl Wilson talks about how he grew to love what he formerly considered the bad music of Celine Dion. An interview is ahead. State-run museums in Illinois are shuttered now that September has slipped into October, and the budget impasse between Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and Democratic leaders in the General Assembly continues. That's the topic of our IPR Politics Roundtable.
I am Brian Mackey. Our panel includes Jamie Dunn, editor of Illinois Issues here at Illinois Public Radio. From Chicago, Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. And joining us by phone, Natasha Korecki, the new Politico Playbook writer for Illinois, formerly of the Chicago Sun-Times. Natasha, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on the new job.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. So, Amanda, I'm going to start with you. Let's begin by talking. The Illinois State Museum did finally close. There was a candlelight vigil here in Springfield Thursday night, but state workers there, at least the ones who are left, are still getting paid. They're still on the clock. They're still reporting to work.
And that's where you've gotten just a ton of backlash from legislators, from Democrats, but really even some Republicans that I think are having a hard time swallowing this. They say it just doesn't make sense. I mean, you have the air conditioning running or the heat on now that it's gotten chillier, I guess. And you still have the building that is sitting there that was just actually earlier this year rededicated. Supporters say this museum made it through, you know, the World War. It's been around and now gone. And for what, they say, some really small and meager savings, particularly now that you still have state employees that are there. Some will temporarily be reassigned to other duties, but people are questioning, what are they going to do? Just twiddle their thumbs?
Yeah, and we've had a number of high-level departures there as people have kind of seen where mm-hmm. this has been going. But, Jamie, I don't know that we really – I think a lot of people are still scratching their heads over why are we closing the State Museum. All right? It's not unprecedented for government to fund museums. We have the Smithsonian in Washington here. But I don't feel like – or maybe you can tell me.
A lot of states have state museums,
right,
actually.
Right, right, mm-hmm. right. So, I mean, have we heard a rationale for, you know, why this is really where Illinois needs to save money at this time as opposed to the other billions and billions of dollars the state spends?
Well, of course, it's been framed as a budgetary issue. But as Amanda said, when you talk to folks, you know, who are close to the museum, who care about the museum, they're very frustrated and feel like the justification just isn't there and that there hasn't been enough explanation as to why this is a smart move budget-wise, because when it boils down to it, not a lot of savings, probably going to lose a lot of institutional knowledge from folks who may seek employment elsewhere. And then, of course, the state still has, in some cases, a legal responsibility to maintain some of these collections. So it's not like Illinois can just walk away from this situation.
Yeah, and this is the State Museum gets called in when if there's a construction project and I believe Native American remains are discovered or something like that. There are, you know, important not only tourist roles, as a lot of people might think of it here in Springfield. It's a place where you have events and there are other sites around the state people can visit, but they do have some legitimate scientific and cultural functions as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's an entire research arm that I think often goes unnoticed. When you say museum, it is that, but it's more. It's that entire expertise, the scientists, the, you know, PhDs who are there that are really getting in and doing those studies. I should add also that there's a the Dixon Mounds also closing, and then there's the Lockport Gallery facility. I did speak briefly with the mayor of Lockport, who says, hey, the state can't necessarily close this down. I'm working with the person who we rent the space from, and right now Lockport's doing that. That's not something that the state is doing. What right does the governor have to do this? He said he did have a conversation with Governor Bruce Rauner, and that's kind of one of the separate questions. Once and if Illinois has a budget, will the museum and these other facilities be reopened? Number one, will it be too late? Or number two, is this something that perhaps the people that go to the museum really, really do love it and support it? And a lot of Springfield area students go there, but it's not like it is one of the, you know, big tourist draws where you get people coming from throughout the state or throughout the world to go to the state museum. Is this something where, you know, Bruce Rauner, who says that Illinois needs to get more lean, looks at this and, you know, his directors have basically questioned what all does the state need to be in the business of doing, and that maybe it's the end of the museum period, regardless of what happens with the budget.
Yeah. So, Amanda, you mentioned something earlier that some lawmakers are beginning to raise questions about this in particular because, as we said, you know, there are a number of workers who are still getting paid there. You mentioned the heat, the air conditioning. The workers are there because AFSCME, the largest public employee union here in Illinois, has filed a lawsuit saying that the layoffs notices were not done properly and you can't just lay people off for sort of what they're saying is an arbitrary reason. Natasha, I want to turn to you, though, because this question of lawmakers raising questions about the governor, something you wrote about. Are we getting the sense that there is some kind of bubbling up? I mean, so much of the public attention on this budget dispute has been sort of Rauner versus House Speaker Michael Madigan, the governor versus the speaker. Are you getting a sense that rank and file lawmakers are beginning to feel left out of the fun in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happening is, you know, they're over the summer, they were going to Springfield every week, not accomplishing anything or much, at least. Now they're back in their districts, and people are coming to them and saying, like, hey, we're feeling the effects of this. And, you know, A, social service agencies feeling the effects of it, small businesses feeling the effects. But not only that, I mean, just you talk to fiscal conservatives like David McSweeney. Yeah, he told us that we need to rise up. Members need to rise up. They're tired of being viewed as, you know, Mike Madigan and Bruce Rauner, you know, puppets, that they're, you know, for a while they drew the line in the sand and they stood with their parties, but now they're realizing it's not doing them any good. They're not having a voice. And, you know, and then even these conservative Republicans are going back and talking to their constituents who are saying, well, wait a minute, how is this good financially for the state? I mean, we've all been talking about it to death and hearing it, but the every day that goes by, it's going to cost more money for the state. If we get a downgrade, it's going to cost more to borrow. It's just the backlog of bills is compiling. You know, we're running by court order and consent decree and so forth. So it's not the right way to run. And, you know, for the most part, we're not going to go back to Springfield now until October 20th. I mean, that's a long time. So yeah, there's a lot of frustration.
Sure. And I was just going to say, I mean, one of the reasons that it's costing more money is that we're spending at last year's levels without having made any cuts to try and bring, we had an automatic tax cut that took effect in January, right, Jamie? And then now we are still spending, though, at levels as though we had all that money pouring in. We're going to be billions and billions of dollars short.
Yeah. And I think Natasha makes a good point. Even the folks that want to see the state budget cut don't want to see it cut like this. You know, the decisions of where to cut are being made not by the legislature for the most part, but by court orders, where some areas of government are definitely getting funded because there are judges saying that they have to, whereas other areas aren't getting funded at all, higher ed being, you know, a pretty big example of that. A lot of the folks who'd like to see budget cuts, I don't think, are out there advocating for let's cut all funding to higher ed. They would like to see more strategic, well-planned budget cuts, and this is definitely not a strategic or well-planned situation.
Speaking of higher ed, we did have the 9 presidents of the public universities in Illinois collectively actually sent a letter that basically said this is getting out of hand. And while some are able to continue longer than others because they have additional tuition dollars, they're bigger foundation support, but there are others. So you look at Eastern that has already, you know, moved and had to make budget cuts, moving to let people go, for example, that are unable to sustain getting $0. So they've asked for a meeting and urged the governor. It was this really eloquent letter that tried to back off any political blame, but tried to make the point of how important they are and said state money is a key part of our agreement together that right now the state isn't fulfilling. There's that. And then I just also did want to get back to what we Natasha had brought up and we had been saying in terms of rank and file members rising up and what are they going to do. And it's one of those where Illinois just does have this structure. It's very leadership driven. It is difficult for 177 members to all get together. There is that frustration, I think, very much on the part of people who are watching the budget, those that are impacted, but also legislators who, you know, when you talk to them, they say their phones are ringing off the hook now with people that are concerned about the budget situation. And yet where they're getting together, it also it seems as if they're being driven further apart and into their separate partisan corners because of how long this is dragging out. So on one hand, it's as if there's an incentive to come together because things have gotten so bad. And on the other hand, they're all the more entrenched. The more that time goes on, they're kind of clinging to their teams.
You know what I think, just to interject a little too, is what I think is interesting is, you know, Rauner's been very against this whole idea of calling a special session. He says they're a waste of time and money and so forth. But, you know, I try to get something out of the governor's office. It was late last night when I asked, but I still have not heard anything, any response on that. And then, you know, I saw a couple other reports where the governor's office just wouldn't directly respond to that. So I find that interesting. I wonder if he is taking it. You know, you had the Chicago Tribune editorial sort of calling for him to, you know, set a deadline, do something by a certain deadline. So yeah, you just kind of wonder if there's some movement there in his thought process.
That's Natasha Korecki, who writes the Chicago-based Politico Playbook, along with Amanda Vinicky, Jamie Dunn, and the IPR Politics Roundtable, moderated by Brian Mackey. I'm Willis Kern, and this is Sound Ideas. Carl Wilson is a music critic. His job is to tell people why certain music is good and why other music is not. You could call him a tastemaker, but he started to wonder, how does taste even work? To find out, he immersed himself in the music, life, and fandom of Celine Dion. With more, here's Bullseye's Jesse Thorne.
In 1997, Elliott Smith was nominated for an Oscar. It was unusual. He was an indie rock hero, uncomfortable on any stage, much less a stage with an audience of 40 million, just in the U.S. When Smith performed, music critic Carl Wilson was rooting for him. Smith was standing in the middle of the stage, looking a bit lost, and playing an acoustic guitar.
Do you miss me? Miss misery like you say?
Of course, the competition that year was close to unbeatable, a juggernaut of the middle brow, one of the most popular and one of the most reviled artists in pop music history, Celine Dion, who took the stage, incidentally, on a recreation of the Titanic.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you.
Carl Wilson was watching the Oscars that night, and he found himself wondering why he loved Elliott Smith and detested Celine Dion, or at least told people that. Maybe it was his problem. Wilson was already a Quebecer, closer than most to the epicenter of Celine's global reach, so he immersed himself in her world. The result was a book called Let's Talk About Love, Why Other People Have Such Bad Taste. doesn't just examine Celine's Triple Diamond album, although it does examine that. It also questions what taste is and why we care so much about it. I spoke to Carl Wilson last year. Carl Wilson, it is so great to have you on the show. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Gosh, I was trying to think of where to start, but let's start with why you thought it would be a good idea to write a book, not just about Celine Dion and not just about that record, but about taste. Like, what was interesting to you about examining what taste is?
Well, you know, by the time I wrote the book, which was, you know, almost 10 years after that Oscar night, I'd been working as a music critic as part of my career for quite a while at that point. And I was more and more questioning what the objective basis, if anything, for the opinions I was offering and the analyses I was offering was, and why I had more authority by any stretch of the imagination to judge a piece of music or a piece of art than other people did, and then why anybody does.
In 1997, which is now 17 years ago, how old were you?
I was in my 20s, early 20s. So yeah, I was working at an alternative weekly in Montreal, not that long out of university, and was the arts editor there.
When you are in your young adulthood, and especially your teenage years, you construct a huge amount of your identity out of cultural signifiers. You know, whether it's mods versus rockers or, you know, hip-hop heads versus pop music fans, or, you know, whether it's people that like rap music and hate R&B. You know, it is a huge part of who you are, maybe just because you haven't filled that space in with actual life experiences yet.
Yeah, maybe that's part of it. I mean, I think the interesting thing and the contradiction that's really hard to tease out is the question of how much of that is an internal experience and how much of it is a social experience, right? And one of the things that sociological research tends to show is that these patterns fall consistently along lines of class and income and education and demographic influences like that in a way that would seem kind of suspicious if it were just everybody making up and doing their own thing. It really starts to seem like what we are doing is a lot of social signaling, and we're trying to tell the world who we are and who we aspire to be, and also who we don't want to be. And that's, you know, I think in the book that was became kind of my central concern. And I think a lot of that mechanism happens really unconsciously. And, you know, I think that it's a little counterintuitive, you know, if you kind of describe to anybody that notion, there's a real desire to defend yourself against that and say, no, I just like what I like, man. And I think if you look closely at it, that doesn't stand up to scrutiny. And it's one of the reasons that I think, you know, and I think it's natural as you get older to start to see those things and those patterns and become more introspective about them. But I think we also pass through that phase and leave it behind without quite sometimes realizing what it's meant.
Let's get down to brass tacks. And by brass tacks, I'm referring specifically to Celine Dion.
Sure.
She seems to, she sort of appears out of whole cloth as a kind of representation of down the middle adult pop banality in, you know, the mid 2000s or whatever, right? Like, she just represents neutral in a lot of ways. But in fact, she comes from a really specific cultural milieu that you describe, and I found your descriptions of it really fascinating in the book. Can you tell me a little bit about, first, about what kind of Quebecer she is and why that matters in the cultural landscape of Quebec and sort of the world that she came up in as a child star?
Yeah, I think that Celine kind of comes out of the period when Quebec was undergoing enormous change. You know, she was sort of born into that world, because in the 60s and 70s, Quebec went from being what was kind of, you know, it sounds funny to say, but kind of an oppressed minority culture in which, you know, English bankers basically ruled the province, and the Catholic Church was kind of complicit in keeping this kind of French working class in its place. And in the 60s, Quebec went through what's called the Quiet Revolution, in which the French majority really rose up and said, we want to become masters of our own destiny. So all of that was happening in Céline's childhood. And one of the things, and she really, you know, came from a sort of outer suburban, almost rural, small area in a big Catholic family with, you know, a dozen brothers and sisters. And she, in some ways, straddles that divide. So it, as a child, she started sort of singing in her family restaurant, singing, you know, hymns and traditional French songs. And her family got the idea that there might be something in this, and introduced her to managers. And so in the 80s, when she was kind of becoming a child star, she was transitioning out of this old Quebecois traditional entertainment culture into the sort of new globalized entertainment culture that, you know, record labels and the like were creating alliances in Quebec with that. And as an adult, she's become this representative of the modern, commercialized, globally savvy Quebec. And that's kind of the journey that she's gone through. And I think that we end up seeing this kind of popped out of nowhere person with these weird kind of variety show, old-fashioned entertainment values. And it's in some ways because she comes from this place that modernized, you know, relatively almost overnight, in a way that's not familiar to the rest of us.
There's more of the interview with music critic Carl Wilson tonight at 8 during Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. Jesse also talks to one of the people who helped make hip-hop what it is today, Russell Simmons. That's on Bullseye tonight at 8, and you can also hear the show every Saturday morning at 11 here on GLT.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas. I'm contributing listener Kat Woods. Let the GLT news staff know what you think of this show by posting comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can also tweet. We're at WGLT News. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas.
Every day, you invite GLT into your home through your radio or smartphone. During this Fund Drive campaign, GLT is inviting you to help build a home. Every contribution to GLT will provide 2x4s to Habitat for Humanity thanks to Heinz Supply. It's our Listen, Pledge, Build partnership.
I'm Dylan Huntley. Thanks for your contribution to GLT. You're providing lumber for 3 new Habitat homes, like mine.
Learn more about our Listen, Pledge, Build partnership and make your contribution at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
I'm Willis Kern, and this is Sound Ideas. Tomorrow, you'll have a chance to talk with 2 members of the Normal Town Council. They're meeting tonight to discuss possible funding sources from the 1% sales tax increase that goes into effect next year. Mayor Chris Coos and longtime council member Cheryl Gaines will be in the studio to take your questions. That's tomorrow during Sound Ideas. Jazz vocalist Michelle Lordy grew up listening to the great jazz combos in the clubs of her hometown in Philadelphia. B3 great Trudy Pitts was a particular favorite, but she was also enamored with jazz legends Chet Baker and Blossom Dearie. On this edition of GLT Jazz Next, Lordy talks to John Norton about her new album Drive, the sometimes tense relationship between vocalists and instrumentalists, and how she approaches her craft.
I'm a collector of songs. I'm a collector of beautiful songs. And I try to do my best not to screw them up.
Now that's the shortest elevator speech I think I've ever heard. You've got 20 more seconds.
You're my thrill.
Why don't we play off of what you just said? And this is a beautiful album. You are trying to convey some beauty, some melodicism. How did you come to your understated style, at least on this album?
This album was put together at a time when I was, and my whole family was in mourning for the loss of my ex-husband. And I happened to meet meet up with Oren Evans and play some music with him in 2014. And we talked a lot about the direction I was going in for my first album. And Oren said something to me that really stuck out. And he said, why don't you just play your favorite songs to sing right now and not try to make an album that is, you know, one bossa, an up-tempo number here, another up-tempo number there. He said, why don't you just make a list and say, these are my favorite 10 songs to sing right now. We made a list, and it was really the songs that I love to sing. And he would call me on it. He's like, I haven't heard you sing that lately. Why don't you sing it if you love it?
Where's my will? Why this strange desire?
The songs that you hear on the album turn out to be just a little moment in time for me then. And as you can hear, they're pretty somber. And I think they're, you know, I think they're beautiful tunes, all of them. But there's definitely a somber mood that is due to the loss that my family experienced not long before that. What I realized is I didn't know that I had made a somber album until we completed it. You know what a cabinet museum is? A cabinet of wonder?
No.
Have you ever heard of that term? Okay. I have a big interest in natural history, and one of my favorite things in the world are these, they call them Victorian cabinet museums. And before museums were organized, people would just bring beautiful items together from, you know, someone would say, this is a feather from a bird of paradise, and next to a beautiful knit, you know, some kind of piece of fabric from Africa. Then, you know, next to that, we have a tooth from a what might be a dinosaur, you know, that kind of thing. And what I realized is I had created a cabinet museum of music trying to capture this mood and feeling. It doesn't really make sense as an album, to tell you the truth. I wouldn't set out to make an album of ballads the way I did. That's not commercially intelligent, but that's what happened.
While I give to you and you give to me true love.
Let's talk about some of the songs specifically then.
Sure.
If I Only Had a Heart is one of the songs on this brand new album called Drive. You know, what is it about this song that you wanted to be on the album, or that it's one of your top 10 favorites at the time?
It is one of my favorite songs to sing. It comes from getting a lot of requests for another song from that show, Wizard of Oz.
Over the Rainbow.
A lot of people ask singers to sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which is a beautiful song by Harold Arlen. But I've always shied away from singing the kind of blockbustery songs. I kind of thought, you know, I don't want to turn people down if they want a certain song, but it's not really my thing to sing that song. So I came up with singing If I Only Had a Heart. In the recording that everyone's familiar with, it's very bouncy. Usually people remember the If I Only Had a Brain version, of course. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it might be fun to take it, slow it down. I think it's got a lot of sweetness and a lot of sadness in there, too.
How sweet just to register emotion, jealousy, devotion, and really feel the pulse. I would stay young and chipper, and I'd lock it with a zipper if I only had a heart.
This Anita Songs from the album Drive. Michelle Lordy is our guest here on GLT. Another song on the album is I Fall in Love Too Easily. It's a song that I associate with Chet Baker, you know, with our chat off the air, and a little bit you mentioned. I'm guessing that you fall into the I Love Chet Baker camp.
I think I might have that sticker somewhere on my binder, like my high school binder. Yes, I definitely love Chet Baker. I was introduced to I actually didn't know he sang for a couple years. I was introduced to his music in my teens. than when I heard Chet. I think the album is The Best of Chet Baker Sings, which is a great album. Lots of wonderful tunes that are a little bit less common. Yeah, I love the way he voices with his trumpet and his voice a tune, and how you can hear. You hear every word, you hear how he feels about the lyric, and he has great taste in picking tunes.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard for love to
a duo with Oren Evans. Anytime I sit down next to Oren, I'm never quite sure what's going to happen. I do know that he always is very true to the lyric of the song. His sense of time is so great, and it's really challenging to me, and I think this song came off really well.
Well, as a vocalist, how important is it to have, say, a pianist who knows how to, what's the word I might want to use?
Accompany.
Okay, yeah.
There are a lot of wonderful pianists. There are less wonderful accompanists who are wonderful pianists. I have the pleasure of working with several wonderful accompanists. Oren, of course, and I work with Michael Kanin, who is the music director and pianist for Jane Monheit.
There's some tension within the jazz community. I'm sure you're well aware of it.
Yeah.
But there's this disrespect for vocalists. And for some, it might be earned. But for most, I think vocalists have to work especially hard to get the respect of instrumentalists. And there's this tension between the two that... But I think sometimes vocalists get automatically assumed that they don't know what they're doing. You have to prove yourself almost every time, where an instrumentalist doesn't necessarily have that kind of tension.
Oh, I agree. I also think that just the way it works out is usually a vocalist is also the band leader. Not always, but in my case, I'm usually leading the band that I'm with. So there's kind of a double pressure, but I have a lot of respect for vocalists who lead bands and deal with the pressure that causes. I think that a vocalist should be a benefit to a musical situation, and sometimes they're not. The lyric is such an important part of an experience, but I think that if the vocalist does not respect the lyric, that's where you get into a situation where vocalists can be, let's say, picked on.
Long ago, my heart and mind got together and designed a wonderful boy for me. Oh, what a fantasy.
Well, another song you decided to record on the album is the last song on the album, which the title track comes from. It's Drive. It's a song from the 80s pop rock band The Cars, and I'm guessing it's not just a fun little thing. There's something more going on here.
Drive is definitely a departure from the rest of the songs on the CD. I do incorporate a lot of music from my youth in sets. I do other covers of 80s and later songs. I feel that the American Songbook is evolving and that we need to add songs to that. And I always thought that Drive had such a sad heart. I thought that song was so sad at its core. And what I, you know, what you might remember from it is dancing to it at a high school dance, and all the synthesizers and kind of the wispy nothingness. But if you get down to the lyric, it's I think there's a lot there. And I was especially interested in hearing what Oren would do with that song. And I think that we were definitely on the same wavelength there with what came out.
Well, Michelle Lordy, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the album Drive. Boy, we're so happy for you. This is wonderful. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for playing my music.
Who's gonna tell you when it's too late? Who's gonna tell you things aren't so great? You can't go on thinking nothing's wrong. Who's gonna drive you home tonight?
That's Philadelphia native Michelle Lordy with the title track to her new album, Drive. You can listen to other new jazz albums and artists by clicking Jazz Next on the music link at WGLT.org. Check out the podcast of Sound Ideas at our website. Our updated site also has a Sound Ideas tab on the homepage where you can quickly link to recent interviews, such as the Ella Stryker interview you heard earlier in this program and your favorite recurring segments on the show. Today's Sound Ideas comes to you with help from John Norton and editor Taylor Bauer. I'm Willis Kern. Gonna hang it up. This is WGLT Normal News and Ideas.